Chapter 5 The Eternal War of the Tyrants. There's something you should understand about evil individuals and governments. They make terrible allies. It is perhaps their greatest vulnerability. It might appear otherwise, as it often seems like evil individuals are always scheming about who they can get on their side, while the good people are going about their lives blissfully unaware of the storm clouds gathering in the distance. The good guys always seem to only get their act together 2 minutes before midnight, snatching victory from the jaws of imminent defeat. But as evil individuals approach the implementation of their plans, fighting usually breaks out, because the alliance was never about sharing. It was always about gaining a temporary advantage over a perceived rival, sidling him while they were weak, and then attacking their former ally when they'd regained their strength. Consider Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin as World War II began in Europe. Hitler knew the dictator Stalin and Soviet Russia would present a problem when he attacked Poland. So the two of them signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact on August 22, 1939, as detailed by the Manchester Guardian newspaper in Britain at the time, and reprinted in 2019 by The Guardian. Germany and the Soviet Union have agreed to conclude a pact of non-aggression. The surprising announcement was made in Berlin last night by the official German news agency. It was added that Herr von Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister, is flying to Moscow tomorrow to complete the negotiations. Early this morning, the Russian TASS agency issued a similar statement. The news was completely unexpected. There had been rumors in Berlin of a meeting at Berchtesgaden yesterday between Herr Hitler, Herr von Ribbentrop, and Herr von Papen, who had recently visited Moscow, but that was all. The decision to sign the pact is announced only the day after the signing of a commercial treaty was made known. The Russian press yesterday, suddenly changing its tone toward Germany, warmly welcomed the commercial agreement as being likely to lead to better political relations eventually, they said. Tyrants understand that they can be opposed not only by democracies, but by other tyrants. Hitler and Stalin had been at each other for years. Hitler rose to power on a promise to stop communism in Germany. And yet, there they were in August 1939, signing a non-aggression pact. And did you notice how it began with a commercial agreement? Economics and war are inextricably linked. But there was no genuine accord between the two states. Hitler wielded ultimate power in Germany by co-opting big business with his promise to crack down on the unions, which wanted to improve worker wages and living conditions. Stalin wielded ultimate power because the state had taken over all the businesses. Germany and Russia made short work of Poland. Then, after 8 months of the so-called phony war, Hitler turned west, quickly dispatching France, and drove the English army to the French beach of Dunkirk, where they made their miraculous escape back to Britain's shores. With the war in Western Europe seemingly won, and only England left perilously clinging to life, Hitler turned back to the east. But was any agreement with a tyrant one that another tyrant could trust? By the end of 1940, Hitler had issued Führer Directive 21, an order for Germany's planned invasion of the Soviet Union. Codenamed Operation Barbarossa, after the nickname of the powerful medieval Holy Roman Emperor Frederick I, the invasion called for German troops to advance along a line running north-south from the port of Archangel to the port of Astrakhan on the Volga River near the Caspian Sea. Hitler hoped to repeat the success of the Blitzkrieg in Western Europe and win a quick victory over the massive nation he viewed as Germany's sworn enemy. On June 22, 1941, more than 3 million German and Axis troops invaded the Soviet Union along an 1,800-mile-long front, launching Operation Barbarossa. It was Germany's largest invasion force of the war, representing some 80% of the Wehrmacht, the German armed forces, and one of the most powerful invasion forces in history. That's the version you'll find in most history books. Hitler and Stalin made a pact, and Hitler broke it, completely surprising Stalin. But with the ascension of Prime Minister Mikhail Gorbachev and his campaign of openness, or perestroika, wherein the records could be more closely examined, a different view of the duel between Hitler and Stalin began to emerge. A contentious debate has broken out on what Stalin was planning, with some researchers claiming Stalin was planning to attack Hitler just a few weeks after the German invasion. As detailed in the Inquiries Journal, the idea was first raised by historian Viktor Suvorov. Besides allowing Soviet historians greater, though far from complete, access to archival documents, perestroika also allowed the greater freedom of interpretation, which was eagerly seized upon by historians such as Suvorov, as a chance to deconstruct the Soviet myth of the Great Patriotic War. Suvorov's thesis was simple. Stalin intended to attack Nazi Germany in the summer of 1941, and therefore rejected the dominant view in Western and Soviet scholarship on the subject that the Soviet Union was a defenseless victim of German aggression. In the mainstream narrative of World War II, Stalin was betrayed. But I tend to side with those who believe that Stalin was also planning to attack Hitler. That's the way tyrants think. Suvorov added more detail to this theory. Suvorov focuses on the mobilization of the Red Army in the months immediately preceding the German attack as evidence of Stalin's intention to launch a preemptive offensive against Nazi Germany. He points to the movement of numerous Red Army units from the Ural Mountains to the Ukrainian and Belarusian frontier regions. Suvorov views June 13, 1941, as being the point at which the Soviet Union effectively decided on war, as he argues that the deployment of troops and material could not be reversed without resulting in severe economic disruption. Additionally, Suvorov interprets Stalin's appeasement of Hitler during this period as an elaborate plot to conceal his intentions to launch a preemptive strike against Hitler, and focuses on the Telegram Agency of the Soviet Union, TASS, directive of June 13, 1941, as indicative of Stalin's wider campaign of deception. Suvorov saw Stalin's foreign policy as fundamentally rooted to Marxist-Leninist ideology. Viewed from this perspective, Stalin aimed at pursuing world revolution and further contended that Hitler was merely an icebreaker in Stalin's wider plan of spreading Soviet rule throughout Europe. This version of history makes much more sense to me than painting Stalin as a passive, trusting fool who was duped by Hitler. Whatever one might say of tyrants, they are rarely dumb. Suvorov makes the point that the disposition of Stalin's forces suggested the Soviets were ready to go on the offensive within a few weeks, which is why they performed so poorly against Hitler's onslaught. In Suvorov's estimation, Stalin was no more than 3 weeks away from launching an attack on Hitler when Hitler attacked Russia. Tyrants are generally astute judges of human natures, in the way that bullies normally have high social intelligence, as detailed in this 2011 article from the Journal of Personality and Individual Differences. Relative to victims, both bullies and defenders showed advanced moral competence integrating information about beliefs and outcomes in judging the moral permissibility of an action. Victims show delayed moral competence, focusing on outcome information alone. Paradoxically, despite the advanced moral competence of bullies, they are woefully deficient with respect to their moral compassion when compared to both victims and defenders. These results parallel a growing body of work on adult psychopaths, suggesting disassociation between the knowledge that guides abstract moral judgments and the factors that mediate morally appropriate behavior and sentiments. I always find it interesting when the latest science confirms our most ancient wisdom. In the typical journey of a hero in literature, he must usually come face to face with the villain in a philosophical contest. Good stories reveal deep psychological truths, which is why they can last for hundreds, if not thousands of years, and maintain a hold on our imagination. The hero and villain want to size each other up, look each other in the eye, so to speak. In this mental battle, the villain usually says to the hero something along the lines of, "You and I are not so different." And there is probably some truth to that observation. Both of them could appreciate the vulnerabilities that may be present in a certain situation. One might say that during the 1930s, both Winston Churchill and Adolf Hitler understood the implications of German rearmament, as well as the overwhelming desire of most European leaders never to have another senseless slaughter of millions, as had happened during World War I. However, the villain steps foot on the road to evil, while the hero chooses the path that brings about the greatest benefit to civilization. Hitler saw the opportunity to cause suffering and death for millions of people, while Churchill vainly tried to warn against the coming apocalypse, hoping he could persuade leaders in Germany to pursue a different path and not leave Europe in smoking ruins. In this light, who are the tyrants of our modern era, and who are the heroes trying to stop a catastrophic confrontation? In my last book, The Great Reset, I wrote a great deal about how the Trilateral Commission, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, and the World Economic Forum made modern China. To recap the main points of my argument, the globalists saw China as the perfect testbed for their theories about how a managerial class could control society, free of democratic restraints. It has worked beyond their wildest dreams of success, and yet they seem to have lost control of their monstrous authoritarian creation. This fascism for a new generation would avoid the vulgar displays of political power necessary to crush opposition, and would instead seek to undermine challenges to their authority by other means. Of course, this opening to China required a betrayal of Taiwan, a mistake we continue to pay for in 2023. We also suffer from the fact that China now seeks to influence our movies, our finances, and our universities through direct financial contributions, as well as the establishment of Confucian schools at our leading centers of learning, and probably financially compromising President Joe Biden and his family. This is how Dr. Brzezinski was lionized after his death in 2017 by Professor Qi Wang, chair of the U.S.-China Policy Foundation. Brzezinski worked with Carter, Oxenberg, and Leonard Woodcock, chief of the U.S. liaison office in Beijing, to move forward with normalization. These four individuals created the environment and strategy necessary for normalization to finally be possible. In May 1978, Dr. Brzezinski insisted on traveling to China. During his meetings with China's Deng Xiaoping, the conditions for handling the U.S. relationship with Taiwan post-normalization were discussed. Finally, in December 1978, the United States and China made joint announcements that the establishment of official diplomatic relationships would occur on January 1, 1979, when Deng Xiaoping visited the United States just after the normalization. He had a special dinner at Dr. Brzezinski's home, showing how appreciative Deng was of Brzezinski's efforts. Without Dr. Brzezinski's tireless behind-the-scenes work, it is doubtful normalization would have occurred so soon. When you read some story in the news today, maybe about China threatening to invade Taiwan, the more than 100,000 overdose deaths in America last year, mostly from fentanyl produced in China, and the hollowing out of our manufacturing capacity because our policy has been to shut down American manufacturing and send to China, as well as the SARS-CoV-2 virus that came from China because they had enough money and assistance from us to create that unsafe biosafety level 4 lab via an intentional or accidental lab leak. Maybe you should remember that this was all brought to you courtesy of Zbigniew Brzezinski and his fellow globalists. And what kind of a human rights record does China have? This is from a 2016 Washington Post article revealing China's genocidal actions against its own citizens. And remember, the Chinese Communist Party was in charge of these efforts and still rules over its citizens. It's as if the Nazi Party remained in power in Germany. Who was the biggest mass murderer in the history of the world? Most people assume that the answer is Adolf Hitler, architect of the Holocaust. Others might guess Joseph Stalin, who may indeed have managed to kill even more innocent people than Hitler did, many of them as part of a terror famine that likely took more lives than the Holocaust. But both Hitler and Stalin were outdone by Mao Zedong. From 1958 to 1962, his Great Leap Forward policy led to the deaths of up to 45 million people, easily making it the biggest episode of mass murder ever recorded. 14 years after China murdered 45 million of its own people, and with the same political party controlling the country, Brzezinski and his globalist buddies like Henry Kissinger were welcoming China into the Community of Nations, and Brzezinski was hosting the Chinese leader at his house for dinner. That's like Hitler winning the war in 1945, and then being invited to President Kennedy's inauguration in 1960. But let Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard go on a fact-finding trip to Syria, hoping to stop President Obama's secret war in Syria, and she'll be denounced as an apologist for the Syrian regime, unfit to be president. And in case you find yourself asking, Syria? We're in Syria? Nah, that can't be. We would have needed some kind of congressional declaration to have troops there, and I know that didn't happen. And yet, here's an Associated Press article on our presence in Syria from 2023. American troops have been in Syria since 2015, but the latest casualties highlight what has been a consistent, but often quiet, U.S. counterterrorism mission aimed at countering Iranian-backed militias and preventing the resurgence of the Islamic State group. On any given day, there are at least 900 U.S. forces in Syria, along with an undisclosed number of contractors. U.S. Special Operations Forces also move in and out of the country, but are usually in small teams and are not included in the official count. Aren't you happy to know our intelligence agencies and military contractors have been waging a splendid little war in Syria over the past couple years, and the mainstream media didn't quite tell you about it. But let's return to our China discussion. 45 million people is a lot to kill. How did they manage the feat? This is how the Washington Post describes it. What comes out of this massive and detailed dossier is a tale of horror, in which Mao emerges as one of the greatest mass murderers in history, responsible for the deaths of at least 45 million people between 1958 and 1962. It is not merely the extent of the catastrophe that dwarfs earlier estimates, but also the manner in which people died. Between 2 and 3 million were tortured to death or summarily killed, often for the slightest infraction. When a boy stole a handful of grain in a Hunan village, local boss Zhang Decheng forced his father to bury him alive. The father died of grief a few days later. The case of Wang Jiyao was reported to the central leadership. One of his ears was chopped off. His legs were tied with an iron wire. A 10-kilogram stone was dropped on his back, and then he was branded with a sizzling tool, punishment for digging up a potato. When I read such a horrifying account, I don't take comfort in the fact that this happened thousands of miles away from me and years before I was born. Instead, it tells me something eternal about human nature. It tells me that the accumulation of all power in a single entity like the state, without protections for the individual, will always lead to such atrocities. Because not all people are good. Jean DeSetti, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Chicago, estimates that about 1% of the general population are psychopaths, who have no empathy for others, and because of this deficiency, are responsible for a disproportionate amount of crime and violence in society. What happens in an authoritarian system? Those who have no empathy are easily able to rise through intimidation and violence against others. An authoritarian system will always give a preference to the psychopaths among us, willing to use the power given to them to maintain their position. Why do I fight so hard against this creeping authoritarianism? It's not because I'm brave. It's because it's in my self-interest to prevent my government from ever having that kind of power over me, my kids, or my grandkids. Would you say I was brave if I ran out of a burning building or tried to escape from a car that was sinking beneath the waters of a lake? Fighting back against tyranny isn't a luxury. It's a matter of your survival. Do you want to live, or are you satisfied with waiting for your executioner to appear? While in my previous book, I detailed at great length the developing relationship between the globalists, first through the Trilateral Commission, which then evolved into the World Economic Forum, and China, the major question of today is the current state of that relationship. Remember, the main argument of this chapter, which is that tyrants can rarely, if ever, maintain a genuine alliance. It seems the Chinese weren't all that interested in being exploited by another group of powerful old white guys. You can hardly blame them. Let's walk through how things have been developing since Deng Xiaoping sat down to dinner at Brzezinski's house for a home-cooked meal. In 2014, at the age of 85, Zbigniew Brzezinski gave a long interview to Michael Hirsch of Politico about his call for a Pacific Charter along the lines of the Atlantic Charter of 1941, which eventually gave rise to NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. One consensus in this interview, that China was starting to move away from the globalists to pursue their own objectives, and Brzezinski was desperately trying to get the monster they'd created back into the castle. MH, what do you think a Pacific charter will achieve? ZB, 75 years ago, in the darkest days of World War II, the Atlantic Charter served as an inspiring proclamation of hope at a time of widespread global anxiety that the world was falling victim to hegemonic tyranny. Today, the presidents of the world's two most important, albeit politically very different, states need to convey credibly to the world their determination to enhance their global cooperation in coping with ongoing and emerging geopolitical crises. Global stability, economic as well as political, is at risk. Shared Sino-American global security goals would not mean that one partner dictates to the other. U.S.-PRC differences will persist, and on the Asian regional level, they can even be a source of mutual irritation. Nor should it mean that we ignore the basic differences between our political systems and values. But a joint affirmation of American-Chinese engagement in sustaining international stability can generate broader collaboration between these two superpowers and containing dangerous threats that actually point also at their own interests. Zbigniew Brzezinski was arguing that the United States should treat the murderous Chinese Communist Party in charge of that captive nation as an equal on the global stage. I've been a longtime admirer of Stephen K. Bannon, the former CEO of Breitbart News, President Trump's campaign strategist for the 2016 election, and one of the deep state's top 10 targets for destruction. However, I have only recently struck up an acquaintance with this genuine patriot, and I'd like to believe it is a budding friendship. Bannon has been crystal clear for years about the danger of China and their gangster leaders. And as Reagan confronted the Soviet Union, not as a fellow superpower, but as an evil empire, I think we must do the same with China. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that any significant political figure that does not make such a declaration should be presumed to be an agent of the Chinese Communist Party. The world probably has no more effective critic of the Brzezinski Doctrine than Bannon, and I completely endorse the criticisms he makes of the Chinese regime, as well as his call for the Chinese people to overthrow the murderous butchers of Beijing. The Politico interview with Brzezinski continued. MH, but is such a pact feasible? Aren't China and the United States too different in terms of their political systems and the way they view the world? They are fighting over internet freedom, democracy, and interests in East Asia. Chinese officials are even hinting that they believe Washington is behind the unrest in Hong Kong. In addition, there is a sense that the Chinese are up and coming and want to replace us. ZB, it is true that the U.S. and Britain shared basic values and political systems that enabled the Atlantic Charter. But in the post-war world, in many ways, their geopolitical interests clashed more than those of the United States and China today. The British at the time wanted to keep their empire, while the United States wanted a United Nations, and the two clashed bitterly over the post-war economic system at Bretton Woods. Today, the United States and China are actually more in alignment on global issues, and especially the global economy, than the United States and Britain were in the post-World War II period. Economically, we are, to some significant degree, interdependent with Chinese well-being. That is a great asset. So this is what gives me some degree of confidence in advocating greater cooperation. We can cooperate to support the dollar and to maintain a steady flow of capital back and forth. But beyond that, we have to ask ourselves, can we do more together to prevent political chaos from exploding in several directions at once? There are so many things wrong in that single paragraph that it can be hard to start pulling it apart, but I'm up for the challenge. First, the fact that America and Britain shared basic values and political systems is probably the most important factor in the success of our long-term alliance with them. Let's be clear-eyed about the facts and not rewrite history. England had a long and hallowed democratic tradition, and it administered a vast empire of millions who, for the most part, didn't want to be ruled by a foreign entity. By its very nature, democracy is incompatible with empire. If a nation is to have an empire, the only way it can be maintained is by the ruthless suppression of those people who want the occupying force to be gone. We learned that in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Vietnam. And yet the lesson doesn't seem to stick among American policymakers, vainly looking for the next foreign monster to destroy, and hoping against all evidence and logic that the residents will celebrate their liberation, as the French and Italians did during World War II. Britain's maintenance of an empire was at odds with their democratic values, just as the institution of slavery was at odds with the lofty claims of the equality of all found in our U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights. While the British were victorious over the Nazis, they were broken at the end of World War II. Empires are expensive to maintain, and Britain had little money, wondering how it was going to feed its own people, let alone all its far-flung colonies. Britain surrendered its empire because it was contrary to its democratic ideals, and, in addition, because it couldn't afford it. Think of the valuable and cherished relationships you have in your own life. Chances are good that you have the strongest relationships with people who share your values, which I hope include honesty, integrity, and kindness. To put it bluntly, at the end of World War II, America had the money it needed and the democratic ideals necessary to bring about greater freedom and liberty to the rest of the world. And in many instances, the United States exercised that power appropriately to encourage the march of democracy across the globe. You do not have a comfortable relationship with people who do not share your values. Having a commonly accepted set of values is critical to any relationship. If you have to work with someone at your job who is undeniably talented, but also has the morals of a snake, you will never rest easy in that relationship. The so-called relationships of convenience or mutual interest are doomed to failure, and it would be better to never even enter them. Probably the most significant single sentence in the previously quoted passage is, "Economically, we are to some significant degree interdependent with Chinese well-being." It is undeniably correct, and yet it comes to the wrong conclusion. There's an old expression in financial circles that if you owe $1 million to the bank, they own you. But if you owe $1 billion to the bank, then you own them. I recommend the fine book by Tom Wolfe, A Man in Full, for a fictional exploration of this theme. In 2022, our trade deficit with China was $328 billion. The normal person might respond by saying, "China has us over a barrel. We don't have any freedom." The reverse is true. We hold the upper hand. China wants to keep getting our money. They must play ball with us if they want that to happen. We can decouple from China, and despite the rate at which we go, China will always be hoping it doesn't go any faster. Of course, all of this is moot if President Xi Jinping, nicknamed Pooh Bear by his critics, because of his resemblance to the classic children's character Winnie the Pooh, is a crazy man. But unlike Russia, which has rolled the dice with their invasion of Ukraine, China always seems to play the long game, never making a move unless they know it's going to be successful. Modern China is best viewed as the Frankenstein monster created by the mad scientist globalists. But instead of the creature's terrifying visage and height that made it unable to blend into the local community, China seeks to wear the disguise of a trustworthy superpower. China can claim it's trying to make the world a better place, pursuing their Belt and Road economic plan, while we figure out how to drop bombs and place special forces in even more countries around the globe. It's troubling to be losing the war for public opinion when our own leaders are making so many mistakes. Xi is aware that the globalists are unhappy with him pursuing his own interests. But to avoid panicking the populace, Xi is acting like everything remains the same. Consider President Xi Jinping's words about globalism that he delivered from the stage of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, on January 17, 2017. At a time when protectionist and nationalist forces are on the rise in the West, President Xi warned against making globalization a scapegoat. Some people blame economic globalization for the chaos in the world. Economic globalization was once viewed as the treasure cave found by Alibaba in the Arabian Nights, but it has now become the Pandora's box. However, the world's problems could not be simply laid at globalization's door, from the heartbreaking refugee crisis to the financial crisis. The international financial crisis is another example. It is not an inevitable outcome of economic globalization. Rather, it is the consequence of the excessive chase of profit by financial capital and the great failure of financial regulation, he said. What could be more believable than the leader of the world's largest crony capitalism economy criticizing free market capitalism? This is called deflection, because in many ways our capitalist system has become little different from China's crony capitalism. That's why I argue that we need to return to a rules-based capitalism. Many players honestly competing with each other for the consumer's trust, without captured federal regulatory agencies, where the employees don't spend years polishing their resumes so they'd look good to the large financial entities like BlackRock when they plan their inevitable leap from government service to the private sector. Xi continued his World Economic Forum speech. After 38 years of reform and opening up, China has become the world's second largest economy. China's development is an opportunity for the world. China has not only benefited from economic globalization, but also contributed to it, he said. Looking ahead, President Xi warned against protectionism. We should commit ourselves to growing an open global economy, he said. He added, China has no intention to boost its trade development by devaluing the renminbi, still less by launching a currency war. News flash to the deluded members of the World Economic Forum from 2017. China did end up devaluing the renminbi, the official currency of China, to boost its global trade sales, and has launched a currency war with the fellow members of the BRICS nations, as I detailed in the previous chapter. Can we start to trace the origins of the fallout between China and the globalists? I think a 2009 interview done with George Soros by Chrystia Freeland, at that time the U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times, and now the deputy prime minister of the captive nation of Canada can help us in answering that question. FT. Given this continued weakness in the U.S. economy, are people right to be concerned about the dollar? GS. Well, they are, of course, and the dollar is a very weak currency except for all the others. So, there is a general lack of confidence in currencies and a move away from currencies into real assets. The Chinese are continuing to run a big trade surplus, and they're still accumulating assets, and basically, the renminbi is permanently undervalued because it's tied to the dollar. There is a diversification from assets that are normally held by central banks into other assets, especially in the area of commodities. So, there is a push in gold, there's a strength in oil, and that is in a way a flight from currencies. This is George Soros telling the world how he plans to run the future. Because of the stupid decisions that have emanated from Washington, D.C., the dollar was in bad shape, even in 2009 after the mortgage meltdown. Although, to be fair, most of the rest of the world's governments had also been making poor economic decisions, because the vast majority of them are globalists. At that point in 2009, it seemed as if the globalists were still planning for China to be the vehicle that the globalists would drive to their preferred future. Little did they know that the Chinese Communist Party would be making plans of their own, which didn't include the globalists. Soros seems to praise the Chinese for their big trade surplus and accumulating assets, while lamenting the undervaluation of the Chinese renminbi because it's tied to the dollar. This is clearly a man who's signaling his intention to work as closely with the Chinese as humanly possible. Soros believes that he has China on his side in his attempt to dethrone the United States as the world's great superpower. He does not understand that the monster will soon be leaving the castle. FT. Does it, the U.S. dollar, at some point, need also to decline against the renminbi? Does there need to be some sort of a new global currency deal? GS. No. I believe that basically the system is broken and needs to be reconstituted. We cannot afford to have the kind of chronic and mounting imbalances in international finance. So, you need a new currency system, and actually, the special drawing rights do give you the makings of a system, and I think it's ill-considered on the part of the United States to resist the wider use of special drawing rights. They could be very, very useful now when you have a global shortfall of demand. You could actually internationally create currency through special drawing rights, and we've done it. This passage should make crystal clear the intention of the globalists to control the money supply, not the national governments. Is it clear now why they hate cryptocurrency so much? They don't control it. They want to be able to print the money and control access to who can use it through their central bank digital currency and social credit scores, showing loyalty to the regime. Once you view these financial arrangements through the lens of who controls the purse strings, it all becomes so clear. Since they are materialists, they think the best way to control people is through their money. And I'll be the first to admit, it's a strong play for global domination. Just the kind of thing a supervillain would try to bring about. The problem, however, is that humans need freedom, like we need air and water, and that those societies with the greatest amount of political and economic freedom are also the most innovative societies. As the interview was conducted in 2009, shortly after Barack Obama took office, you can see that Soros was starting to pick up on the first inklings that China might not be the docile plow horse the globalists had hoped it would be. FT. What sort of financial deal should Obama be seeking to strike when he travels to China next month? GS. I think this would be time, because you really need to bring China into the creation of a new world order, a financial world order. They are kind of reluctant members of the IMF, International Monetary Fund. They play along, but they don't make much of a contribution because it's not their institution. Their share is not commensurate. Their voting rights are not commensurate to their weight. So I think you need a new world order that China has to be part of the process of creating it, and they have to buy in. They have to own it, the same way as, let's say, the United States owns the Washington Consensus, the current order, and I think the makings of it are already there, because the G20, in agreeing to peer reviews, effectively is moving in that direction. I've said for a long time, and my listeners can attest to it, that I generally don't have access to any secret information. The bad guys put all this information out, and the only difference between me and the rest of the media is I read what they put out. They have such control over the media that they can say crazy shit like this, and their media lackeys at ABC, CBS, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, and now Fox, simply act as if it never happened. We have George Soros talking to the future Deputy Prime Minister of Canada about how China will own the new global currency system. How is this not a major issue? As I've said before, there is no doubt the United States has done risky and indefensible things with our economic decisions regarding the dollar. And yet, from that, can I argue, well, let's try having the most murderous regime in history be in charge of the money supply? No. What I will argue is that we need to have better political leaders than we have had thus far. We need to stop printing money when we find it convenient to do so. How has that cozy relationship between the globalists and the Chinese Communist Party been working out lately? Well, in 2016, China and George Soros started calling each other names in public. This is from a Business Insider Australia article on their fight. George Soros is the definition of evil personified, at least according to China's state-run media. In a blistering attack, Chinese media outlets have singled out the famed hedge fund manager for some incredibly harsh criticism of late, essentially blaming him for instigating concerns that rattled financial markets since the beginning of the year. It's just so sad when two dictators have a falling out and start calling each other names in public, almost like hearing the nasty domestic details between a couple going through a divorce. But what was China really expecting from a villain like Soros anyway? They just had to look at his track record. George Soros is an expert in causing chaos among his enemies, although the article tried to take the billionaire's side. Mr. Soros made general comments, claiming that credit in China has reached 350% of GDP and that the hard landing is already happening. "I'm not expecting it, I'm observing it," Soros was reported to have said. Regardless, whether because Soros is high profile or simply because he is known as the man who broke the Bank of England back in 1992, China's power brokers have deemed that the best form of defense is attack when it comes to those talking down the Chinese economy, regardless of what they have actually said. If this was a domestic dispute, lawyers would have already been involved. But since this is a fight between two international titans, the only question becomes, who has more journalists on their payroll, China or George Soros? Judging by their fawning coverage of him, it seems a safe bet that George Soros has more influence with Business Insider Australia than China does. Because China doesn't want to follow the globalist playbook, Soros seems to be fixated on destroying the current Chinese leadership in their current incarnation and replacing them with a group who will submit to his plans. In 2021, Soros was picking a fight with another villainous entity, the behemoth investment firm BlackRock. As CNBC reported, writing in the Wall Street Journal on Tuesday, Soros described BlackRock's initiative in China as a tragic mistake that would damage the national security interests of the U.S. and other democracies. It comes shortly after BlackRock launched a set of mutual funds and other investment products for Chinese consumers. The asset manager told CNBC on Wednesday that its China mutual fund subsidiary set up its first fund in the country after raising 6.68 billion Chinese yuan, $1.03 billion, from more than 111,000 investors. The mind of the average person works in dualities. We want to know who's right and who's wrong, who's the good guy and who's the bad guy. The rest is just details. Normally, this right and wrong predisposition serves us well, allowing us to make choices that benefit us and avoiding decisions that might harm us. Do I stay on my diet, or do I order that delicious-looking cheeseburger? But this useful way of looking at the world can harm us if we don't consider the possibility that we're being given a choice between two bad options. The tasty cheeseburger, or that fabulous ice cream sundae, dripping with chocolate sauce? How did BlackRock respond to these comments by George Soros? The United States and China have a large and complex economic relationship, a BlackRock spokesperson said in response to Soros's comments. Total trade in goods and services between the two countries exceeded $600 billion in 2020. Through our investment activity, U.S.-based asset managers and other financial institutions contribute to the economic interconnectedness of the world's two largest economies. BlackRock's Investment Institute recommended in mid-August that investors boost their exposure to China by as much as three times in some cases. Earlier in the year, CEO Larry Fink, in a letter to shareholders, described China's market as a significant opportunity to help meet the long-term goals of investors in China and internationally. I wonder how it must feel to be the spokesman for an American company wanting to assist the most murderous regime in history. Isn't it long past the point anybody believed that trade would make China more democratic? How did that bet work out? Not very well, I'd say. But back to the good and evil dichotomy, or, as many like to say, the prison of two ideas. You're being provided a false choice. You're either on the side of George Soros, not wanting to do business with the Chinese leaders, or you're against George Soros and think it's fine to do business with the Chinese Communist Party, which is the Chinese government. Why doesn't this article give any context into the argument that both George Soros and the Chinese Communist Party are terrifying authoritarians? Do they think the heads of their readers would explode? In 2022, George Soros was again attacking China, this time at the supposedly conservative Hoover Institution at Stanford University. How is it that guys like Soros, who the left wants you to believe are not trying to do anything, get to be invited guests at prestigious think tanks like the Hoover Institution? Here's a hint. They're all part of the same club. This is from a Fox News article on his talk. Billionaire George Soros on Monday warned that Chinese President Xi Jinping is the greatest threat that open societies face today, and said, "The rise of big tech companies have sharpened the conflict between China and the United States." Soros, a Hungarian-American mega donor known for his backing of liberal causes and politicians, made remarks at the opening of a Hoover Institution panel on Monday evening, beginning by dubbing 2022 as a critical year in the history of the world. In a few days, China, the world's most powerful authoritarian state, will begin hosting the Winter Olympics, and, like Germany in 1936, it will attempt to use the spectacle to score propaganda victory for its system of strict controls, Soros said. We are at, or close to, important decisions that will determine the direction in which the world is going. How is this being allowed to happen? Fox News doesn't even comment on the absolute spectacle taking place before our eyes, with the supposedly conservative Hoover Institution bending their knee to George Soros and not asking some tough questions about his checkered past. This is like letting Joseph Stalin control the editorial pages of the New York Times so he can talk about the evil of Adolf Hitler without being required to account for his own crimes. Even today, I bet the New York Times wouldn't deplatform Stalin. He'd probably be defended by Senator Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist from Vermont, who'd shrug his shoulders and say, "So, he made a few mistakes. At least he tried." And do you notice whenever these authoritarians want to appear less threatening, they choose to sound like a conservative? In October, Soros noted, China will decide whether President Xi Jinping should be given a third term in office as party general secretary, and the United States will hold a crucial midterm election in November. In an open society, the role of the state is to protect the freedom of the individual, Soros said. In a closed society, the role of the individual is to serve the rulers of the state. As the founder of the Open Society Foundations, obviously, I am on the side of open societies, he continued. But the most important question now is, which system is going to prevail? Do I really have to go into all the ways the Open Society Foundations Society is seeking to undermine open societies? Activities such as the funding in major American cities of district attorneys' races, who in turn pursue a soft-on-crime policy to the detriment of minority communities. But I don't want the reader to think it's just the Democrats who are carrying water for China. Who can forget President George Herbert Walker Bush, that patrician of the Republican establishment, who barely even waited for the bodies of Chinese students to be buried after the massacre in Tiananmen Square in June 1989, before he was sending his diplomats over to reassure the Chinese that everything was fine. From an article in the New York Times about the effort, which was kept hidden from the American public at the time. The White House said today that the National Security Advisor, Brent Scowcroft, made a secret trip to China in July, shortly after President Bush suspended high-level meetings with the Chinese government over the June crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators. Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence S. Eagleburger also went on the trip. Word of the July visit came as the White House was still fielding criticism about a more recent visit to Beijing by Mr. Scowcroft and Mr. Eagleburger. The two men went to China 10 days ago to mend relations after hundreds of students, actually it was thousands, died in June at the hands of the Chinese military in Tiananmen Square. That crackdown stirred deep anger and calls for sanctions among the American public and in Congress. The pictures of Mr. Scowcroft during the visit this month, toasting Chinese leaders by candlelight as friends to resume our important dialogue, set off a wave of criticism in the United States. I wasn't a fan of the first President Bush, and I wasn't a fan of the second one either. You may not believe it, but during the two terms of the second President Bush, I was popular among the liberals for my anti-war and anti-globalist stance. Both acted like they cared about you, but were only interested in wars that benefited the military contractors, beggared America, and tried to hand the world over to the Chinese. I don't care how many billions they say I owe. I will never sell out America. My body may give out, but my soul will never bend the knee to these control freaks. If I can find the strength, so can you. History has proven that submission to oppressors only makes things worse. Resistance is victory. The answer to 1984 is 1776. Or, to put it another way, the answer to Marx and Engels is Jones, and Heckenlively. The most clueless take on China must surely belong to former President Obama, who apparently hasn't consulted on the issue with his buddy George Soros. This is from a March 2023 speech in Australia. During a recent speaking event in Australia, former President Barack Obama pinned the blame for China's increasingly hostile behavior on his successor. Observing China's conduct and attitude toward the world began to evolve once I left office, Obama surmised that Chinese President Xi Jinping sensed an opening when former President Trump took command. With my successor coming in, I think he saw an opportunity because the U.S. president didn't seem to care much about a rules-based international system, Obama said, the Daily Mail reported. As a consequence, I think China's attitude is, well, we can take advantage of what appears to be a vacuum internationally on a lot of these issues. Or maybe another way of looking at it is that the rules-based international system that Obama seems to hold so dear was hollowing out the American heartland and creating an unprecedented crisis of despair and drug addiction. And China didn't like it when Trump decided he was tired of getting ripped off by bad trade deals. I also must note that Obama seems to be doing a lot of mind reading of President Xi Jinping. Is that the best he's got? As a former president, doesn't he have access to most of our intelligence? Isn't there some evidence he can point to in justification of his claims? Or is he just spitballing it? Let's take two paragraphs from the article, which at least hint of a balanced approach to the issue. Ironically, Trump long blamed his predecessors, such as Obama, for allowing the United States to get ripped off by unfair trade deals and levied tariffs against Beijing demanding fair treatment. China has quickly emerged as a top foreign policy predicament for President Joe Biden. Earlier this year, a Chinese spy balloon drifted through U.S. airspace for nearly a week, and tensions have been frayed ever since. The House has established a bipartisan committee on China to evaluate the approach to Beijing. Let's put Obama's claims through the logic test. Trump claimed this international rules-based system was bad for America. Maybe that's true, and maybe it's not. I don't claim to know President Xi's mind any better than Obama, but I think his actions give some hint of what he thinks. If the President of the United States mattered to China, then certainly Joe Biden and his love of the international rules-based system should have had Xi jumping up and down with excitement. Back to trade deals that screw the United States. But for some reason, the communists don't seem to be playing ball with China Joe. That's because the Chinese have decided they don't want to be the slave labor for the globalists. They have plans of their own. Some might be tempted to say the globalists have seen the error of their ways, and we should join with them to deal with the threat of China. But the globalists haven't changed their plans. They still want to be our masters. In the future, we are likely to be fighting a two-front war, with China on one side and the globalists on the other. We must be clear-eyed that both China and the globalists present an existential threat to our survival as a free people.